This is WKOK Sunrise on your station for the best news, talk, and sports. News Radio 1070 WKOK and WKOK.com.
Thank you for joining us on WKOK Sunrise. Rob Setter, a fabulous producer. Matt Cotrillo's in the newsroom. In the studio with us now, Dr. Nicholas Inverso is with us. He's a board-certified gastroenterologist. He joined Gastroenterology of Evangelical Community Hospital earlier this year, and he's here to talk to us about the fact that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Having said that particular sentence, that's the sum total of everything you have to say about March being that particular month, but there's so much more to say about this. This is the specialty that we're talking about when we talk about gut health and eating properly. This is your area, right?
That's correct.
And what is gastroenterology? Explain that science.
Well, that is the science of looking at medical conditions related to, as you said, the gastrointestinal system. It's a wide-ranging group of organs and systems in the body that look at the process of digestion, help with your immune system, and elimination of waste products through the body, as well as maintaining a lot of regulation and synthesis of protein in the body. So it's a very broad field.
Well, and a lot can go wrong.
That is very true.
In there, I mean, if you start it with your esophagus, and then you think of individuals that have maybe a stomach dilemma or something in your colon or, a wide range of other issues, there's dozens of things that can go wrong. What is the most common complaint of people?
Well, I think the most common complaint that we see is people who have symptoms of abdominal pain, and that could be pain that varies in location, varies in intensity, and varies in what it's associated with. And our job is to explore that and see if we can come up with a source and then a strategy to help the patient with the symptom.
When you mentioned that half your work isn't a procedure in the procedure room or operating room, it's conversation, it's discussion, it's finding out what you're looking for.
That's true. Most of the time, the information that we get from patients during the interview is instrumental in getting to a diagnosis that helps the patient. Most of the information we need is actually in the history that we gather from them. After that, we refine that process with diagnostics and other types of testing, but really it's estimated that 90% of the information that we need to make a diagnosis is available just in listening to the patient with their complaints.
An endoscopy is this examination that you're doing with a camera. That's just one of the procedures that you can do.
Yes, the majority of what we do is endoscopy. That would either be upper endoscopy, or what we call an EGD, and a colonoscopy, which is looking at the colon lining and sometimes the end of the small intestine, going past the rectum and advancing upward. And those are helpful because they provide a direct visualization of the lining, which is sometimes that we can't always see by other types of testing modalities. In addition, it allows us to take samples if we have something in question. And lastly, if there's something that needs attention and a therapy, we can often apply therapies directly through the scope and at the time of the procedure. So it's a very versatile tool.
All right. Well, your good staffer at Evangelical Community Hospital says you might end up treating celiac disease, colitis, colon cancer screening, constipation, Crohn's disease, diverticulitis, gastroesophageal reflux, hepatitis, irritable bowel syndrome, liver disease, pancreatic disorders, ulcerative colitis. You've seen all of these over the years?
Yes, those and then some.
Not on the same person,
certainly
hope.
Okay. Hopefully not.
Okay. All right. So you have all of these types of issues. How I come to you and I say I have a discomfort, where do you start?
Well, we start again by listening to the description of it. We listen for the timing of it, how long it's been present, what the nature of it is, how frequently it's occurring, what makes it better, what makes it worse, what kinds of therapies you may have tried prior to coming to see us. And we put that information together, and based upon our experience and our education, we try and formulate a what we call a differential, a diagnosis, which means that we look for common things and sometimes less common things that could be a source of those symptoms.
All right, you do the process of elimination. I know doctors sometimes do that, where you cross things off the list. Well, it can't be diverticulitis. You know, it doesn't have X situation or dilemma. How important is family history? Talk about that.
Family history is important, particularly with conditions like inflammatory bowel disease. It's important in conditions such as colorectal cancer or other types of gastrointestinal cancers. We do see a clear association between family members of other generations or same generation and that involving the patient as themselves.
All right, so it would pay an individual to talk to the rest of their family, to everybody, find out sort of what that connection is, because there's genetic links to some of this?
Yeah, that's very true. There's these associations are really important to establish because it's one of the items that helps us piece together what may be going on for someone, because we know they crop up with some level of regularity.
All right. What kind of screening do you have then? So you get that detailed family history and you've done this prolonged interview that gets you all these details. What kind of procedures and screening do you have?
Well, in particular for like colorectal cancer, we have guidelines that we have been established through experts and through time looking at different types of tests that can help us identify patients who are at risk for developing cancer or precancerous changes. And they can be very wide-ranging. They could be anything from collections of stools where we're sampling and looking for products within the stool that would indicate that there is a problem with the lining of the intestinal tract and specifically the colon. There are other imaging type studies which either involve wireless imaging or X-rays or CT imaging that can help us decide whether or not there's something that's abnormal in the lining. And then lastly, what we consider the gold standard is a colonoscopy, where that allows direct visualization. Most of the time, or actually all the time, when you find an abnormality in some test other than a colonoscopy, you still have to get back to a colonoscopy to further work that up. So the advantage of something like a colonoscopy is that you can not only directly do the screening, if you see something at the time you've identified it, and you can actually remove it or at least make a diagnosis of what may be there.
All right, so a colonoscopy, the patient goes through this preparation where they try to clean out their colon, and that involves, we'll talk about that in a second, but then you use the camera to examine the large intestine and the small intestine?
A small distance of the end of the small intestine. So your intestinal tract is laid out specifically, I like to refer to it as a disassembly line. So you take food, and through its journey, you're constantly breaking it down until your body has extracted pretty much everything that's meaningful out of it. And then the rest of it's eliminated as stool. But in that process, each one of those different territories throughout your intestinal tract, esophagus, your stomach, your small bowel, and then the colon, each of them have a job to do. And in that process, we're able to look at, with a colonoscopy, we're able to look at the entire colon in almost all instances, and sometimes we can extend the view into the end of the small intestine called the terminal ileum. And that's an important area that we look to for conditions like Crohn's disease, or if there's any abnormalities in absorbing certain nutrients like vitamin B12, that may be things that help us identify potential sources of those problems.
So. All right. So let's start at the beginning then. Tell me about preparing for this test. What's the right way to do it, and what can go wrong again?
Sure. I think the most important thing about bowel preparation is to recognize that the cleaner you're able to get the colon, the better the endoscopist can be at performing their job. You have to be able to see the lining to be able to detect areas of concern. And sometimes not everything is sizable. It could be a very small area that we have to get to, so we have to make sure that that area is cleansed properly. In addition, in the colon, there's a lot of nooks and crannies, if you will, that things can hide out. So the better it's cleaned out and the less residue is left after your bowel prep, the better the look we can get. The things that you should do is, most importantly, is follow the instructions that are outlined by the person that's giving you the instructions for the the procedure. And a lot of times that starts a few days before the actual test itself. So being aware of the instructions earlier on, not just the night before where you're finally finding that piece of paper and looking through it and running to the pharmacy to get what you need, it would be very helpful to start several days prior to that, even a week earlier, to look and see, well, what kinds of dietary restrictions should I be on over the next several days?
And there are some.
There are some dietary restrictions. This is because the bowel preps that we use, they're good, but there can be certain situations where some foods are not, or residues are not properly cleansed with them. Avoiding them to begin with is a one way to help the process.
What's an avoidable food, real
well,
quick?
Well, we like to avoid many vegetables at the time leading up to it. Most of the time we're telling people to eat vegetables, and you should. But in the instance when we were trying to get the bowel cleansed properly, you want to try and minimize that residue that goes in, because if it's not cleaned out, then it's in the way and it has problems with interfering with visualization. It can affect the scope in clogging the channels that we have in there that allow us to put air and water in or remove debris. So that's an important thing to adhere to. The other advice I would like to give patients would be to make sure they're drinking adequate amounts of water even several days before the test. You should always drink plenty of water unless you have a water restriction for heart or lung reasons. But it's important to drink adequate amounts of water because that also helps in the process of elimination.
All right, and you make sure you want people to follow this, because if you don't have a clear visual on all of this, there's debris still there, you could miss something.
Could miss something, and it actually may prompt a patient to have to come back sooner than the expected interval, because I can't tell for sure that the entire lining of the colon has been adequately viewed.
And nobody wants to do this more than necessary.
Try right? not to do it more than once if you don't.
Right. So, okay. All right. So we're talking about preparing, and then on the day of the procedure, show up at the appointed time, make sure you haven't eaten in X amount of hours, and you're good to go then.
Yes. The day of the test is, most of your work is actually done the days leading up to the test. The day of the test, you actually get a chance to get some sleep, because you'll usually receive sedation in almost all instances. So you don't remember much of the test, but it keeps you comfortable, allows us to do our job and spend the time we need to get a good study performed. And then the rest of that day is kind of an easy day for you. You're not to be operating any heavy machinery or driving vehicles. You'll need a driver that day because of the sedation. But the day before the test, you can do your normal work, and the day after the test, you can return to your normal duties.
But the day of, it's just reading and TV,
it's
and then relaxing. That sounds like a good day. Okay. Mine is the procedure, of course. All right. Well, fantastic. We are going to come back and finish this. I'm so glad you came in. Dr. Nicholas Inverso is with us. He's a gastroenterologist with Gastroenterology of Evangelical Community Hospital. March is Colorectal Awareness Month, Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. And Deanna Hollenbach at Evangelical really hooked us up with a good doc who's helping us. I want to talk about esophageal issues that pop up, more about the colonoscopy, and other factors like race and gender. Big things. They're going to be part of your, well, if they're not obvious, they're going to be part of your interview process. They make a big difference. So stand by, Doc.
News and interviews from your community every morning on WKOK Sunrise on News Radio 1070 WKOK and WKOK.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you're enjoying your breakfast sandwich, you may want to step away from the radio. We're talking about colonoscopies and issues with your gut health, family histories of digestive issues, types of screenings that are available, and we have a gastroenterologist with us. So I guess during breakfast, this conversation ain't for everybody. What do you think? Probably true.
Yes, but important.
How about that? All right. Well, the doctor agrees. Dr. Nicholas Inverso is with us. He's a board-certified gastroenterologist, recently joined Gastroenterology of Evangelical Community Hospital, and he's talking to us about the importance of knowing a detailed family history if you want to avoid colon cancer. Also, a wide range of issues that can affect the esophagus, the stomach, the colon, and your whole digestive system and all of its many interactions. And there's, a lot of things that can go wrong there. So that's really what we're talking about today. Now, you mentioned that race is a factor. The race of an individual, some individuals susceptible to one thing and not others, and so on.
Yeah, that's true. The in particular, African Americans are at a higher risk of developing more advanced lesions when we're dealing with colorectal cancer. And they happen at an earlier age. So when we do endoscopy exams on, or colonoscopy exams on patients, they may find more advanced lesions where they have more breakdown or getting closer to cancer, or in fact cancer that is more advanced than what we would see in a similar age in a non-African American population. And because of that, our recommendations over the years have changed, where we try and move away from a one-size-fits-all and say that it's a 50-year-old start. For African Americans, most people are now agreeing that it's a 45-year when they start their screening, if they're in the average screening risk pool. If there's other things that affect the risk, that changes it, of course. Same thing with in all patients. But in that case, we move it up to 45 years of age.
All right, other race factors, individuals who are Asian or Hispanic, in what way might that
be
a factor?
That's an interesting, because when they look at the epidemiologic studies and many of the statistics on this, there are other factors that will influence who seeks screening. One of them is that it does go by patients who, a level of education sometimes will influence it. Asian population tend to be more faithful in getting their screenings and screening on time. Economic standpoint, a lot of it most likely evolves around access to health care, as well as information about what's important in screening. So people who are very engaged in their health care tend to seek health care at the appropriate times.
And in what way are men and women different?
Well, men, for colorectal cancer, men do have a higher rate of colorectal cancer compared to women. When you look at a lifetime chance of developing cancer, it's about anywhere from a 2-to-3-to-1 ratio for males to females. So it's just a pattern that we identify. We also find that when we're looking at detecting more advanced lesions, advanced precancerous lesions, we'll find there's almost a twofold or a 2-to-1 ratio that we're more likely to find a polyp that has many more worrisome features than in the same age group of females.
But you want everybody at certain ages, and your primary care physician will recommend that, but you want folks to get screenings, get this done.
Yes, and when we look at how we screen and how we make recommendations for screening, we try and stratify any patient into an average risk screening population or a high-risk screening population. Average risk means that there's no background family history or other condition that would make them need a specific type of screening modality, or would have them start either earlier or shorten their interval between subsequent screenings. Whereas the average person who would not have a family history of colorectal cancer, or many people in their family with polyps, they themselves wouldn't have history of polyps or cancer. Once you're identified as being someone who wants to make polyps, that changes the intervals of how we usually screen.
All right,
survey, I should say.
All right, so that happens. The esophagus, you know, we're talking a lot about colorectal cancer and issues that relate to the colon and the large intestine, but what can go wrong with the esophagus, and how do you examine that, and what happens there?
Yeah, for such a tube that usually did not have a lot of its own personality, if you will. In many years, it was thought to be the tube that connects the mouth to the stomach. There are a lot of things that can go wrong with it. In many instances, they can be related to two broad classes of problems. One would be inflammatory conditions where the lining gets irritated, or the lining can change, as in conditions such as Barrett's esophagus. Or you can have motility disturbances where the function of the esophagus to convey materials from the mouth to the stomach doesn't work properly. And they're both diagnosed and identified by different methods, because what's going wrong is different in each of those cases. But they also overlap, because some people who may have problems with reflux may also share motility disturbances, because it has to do with how the esophagus clears whatever comes back up into the esophagus. So if you have stuff stagnant in the esophagus, it increases the contact time of those irritants and can lead to ulcers and inflammation, and sometimes scarring, and sometimes even lead to things like Barrett's esophagus.
Right, and then esophageal cancer, you know, the worst case scenario, very difficult cancer to treat.
It is. By the time, unfortunately, by the time you make a diagnosis of esophageal cancer, it's common that there is either local invasion or spread through the wall of the esophagus, or even involving distant metastases. And with many symptoms of the GI tract, the symptoms that suggest a problem often don't happen until they're in more serious or advanced settings.
So as science advances, better screening is going to be good news, as you hear that coming in, or better, you know, maybe less invasive and more, you know, more sensitive screening tests in the future.
Yes. And when we deal with things like colorectal cancer, we have a variety, as we may have talked a little bit about earlier, of approaches for how we do screening. Some of them are stool-based, some of them are x-ray-based, some of them are direct visualization. Again, in any instance where one of the non-direct visualization, i.e. a colonoscopy, finds something, you always must follow with a colonoscopy, because you've detected that there is some issue at hand that needs to be looked at and addressed.
And then it's mandatory. There are some individuals who do not get fully sedated for some of these endoscopic procedures.
Yeah.
Explain that.
I would say the overwhelming majority choose to take sedation. And is important for them, because I think one of the apprehensive people have is there going to be any discomfort associated with the test. In other parts of the world, however, sedation is not routinely administered. It depends on what you're doing, what the expected length of the test is going to be, and what the expected outcome is going to be. So there's different ways of doing this, but I would say that in our experience, particularly in the United States, most people get some type of sedation.
Or sort of, what do you call it when you're sort of half groggy?
So the what we have today are two different approaches, and more of it is probably moving towards what we call a propofol-based model, which gives you a deeper, more complete type of sedation. It's short of general anesthesia, but it also wears off pretty quickly once the medication stops. Historically, we used to use a combination of what we call conscious sedation, which was a Valium-type drug and a morphine-type drug, and that combination together would put people sort of in a twilight, so they would be responsive or should be easily arousable, but would still fall off. They may not remember the entire procedure, may not remember any parts of the procedure. Depending on the medication, it could sometimes linger a little bit longer, so those patients throughout the day may have times where they were a little bit more groggy waking up from it.
What do you want everybody in the general public to do to sort of be aware of their gut health and be monitoring, you know, the situation? What should everyone do?
That's a good question. The most important thing is to read and learn and look at items that require checkup and maintenance. But the other things are really common sense, is to eat good, well-balanced diets that are not top-heavy in red meats, that are not top-heavy in fatty foods. Watch the development of obesity, and because overweight status can, in some instances, lead to added risk for cancer development. Plenty of fruits and vegetables will always be good. Drink adequate amounts of water. Get your exercise in. Most of those things are just those common sense things that not only affect and positively affect the gastrointestinal tract, but are also good for other systems in the body as well, particularly heart and lungs and.
And cigarette use is a factor in colon health?
Yes, cigarette use is a problem with that, as it is with many organs in the body. It can increase the risk statistically that people develop polyps and cancer.
Right. Well, yeah. Geez, that's well, that's a good enough reason to quit, right?
Exactly.
There. How about that? Gastroenterology of Evangelical. Go to evenhospital.com. Gastro. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, so we're calling attention to that, but also all sorts of issues that might relate to gut health. The doctor in our first segment really suggested and emphasized, you know, a detailed family history, that there's different types of screenings. Not everything ends up in a sedated endoscopy, that you have other techniques at your disposal, and that when you do the prep for a colonoscopy, do it 100% right. Don't skip any steps or
say it. That's correct. The better we can see, the better we can provide you quality health.
So you want that done right. All right. Well, I only have about 1,000 more questions,
okay.
So we're going to have to do it on another visit. But we really appreciate you coming, and thank you. You're off to the hospital now and another
work
day.
Yes.
All right. Fantastic. And you mentioned half of your day isn't procedures. Half is just interviews and getting to know patients and doing that extensive interview that leads to a good diagnosis. So.
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Well, thank you so much for visiting. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Nicholas Inverso, board-certified gastroenterologist at Evangelical Community Hospital.